Is it okay?
You look so good and better without the robe.
Thank you. So there's an old yeshivish joke about why Sefer Iyov is not learned in Kolel. Anybody know why in Kolelim they don't learn Sefer Iyov? Because it says the word job on the front cover. Okay. But in truth, there's another book that's also generally not learned in Kolelim, and that's Rambam's Moreh Nevuchim. And that's for a different reason. That's because Moreh Nevuchim, the guide of the perplexed, that's supposed to get us out of our perplexity, sometimes it can be translated as guide to perplex, because when you read it, you end up with more questions than you had going in. And so what we're going to attempt to do tonight is read both of these works, both Sefer Iyov, through the lens of Moreh Nevuchim, which makes our job exponentially difficult. But I selected four chapters for us to look through that I think summarize Rambam's approach to it, and with your help, hopefully, we'll try to get some insight. I have to say, for me personally, the Moreh Nevuchim, although, of course, it always brings up questions, has solved, for me personally, so many difficulties and has really been a guide for me in this and many other subjects. And I hope to show you why I think so tonight. Okay, so to summarize where we're up to since last week. In general, if you look at most of the books of Tanakh and most rabbinic literature, there is a majority traditional view regarding suffering and evil in the world, which is that if someone suffers, then they must have done something wrong to deserve it. All suffering, all death, all problems are due to the person's own fault, some wrong that they did. That's the traditional view. However, the book of Iyov directly addresses this question, and on the face of it, when read plainly, it offers a dissenting view, a minority view, but still, in a way, a very traditional view itself, because it goes way back. And in the book itself, Iyov rejects the view and says, I did not do anything wrong. The three friends represent the wisdom tradition, the traditional view. But Iyov says, no, I did nothing wrong. And in fact, we know, because we read the beginning, we know the story of the bet that they took. You've seen Trading Places, right? This is all due to a bet between Satan and God about who could win. And that's why Iyov is suffering. And Iyov says, no, I did nothing wrong. Or even if I did, nothing to deserve this kind of terrible suffering. And in the end, God decides the bet. And God says, Iyov is right, and the friends are wrong. And so, therefore, the conclusion is that some people do suffer unjustly. Okay, that's the plain reading of the Sefer Iyov. But then it brings up another question. If some people suffer unjustly, not everybody, but some people do, why does God allow that to happen? And that is even more troubling in a way than the first question. So we saw that Chazal in Midrashim, in Masechet Baba Batra, go through, and there are many different opinions there. Was Yov Jewish? Was he not Jewish? And so on. But I would say the majority opinion among the rabbis is that, in fact, Iyov was not a perfect individual. He served God only out of fear. He was not so great. He deserved what was coming to him. And, well, why did he get reward in the end? God gave him reward in the end so that he would not get Olam Haba. Oh, but didn't God say Iyov was right? No, he didn't mean Iyov was right. What he really meant is we should excuse what people say when they're under tremendous pressure. And so, although Iyov said really blasphemous things, we won't hold him to account for it. That's what it means in the end when it says Iyov was right and the friends were wrong. And so, you see what the Midrashim do is take Sefer Iyov, which is really a dissenting view, and harmonize it with the majority view that you see in Mishle and lots of other places, that good comes to good and bad comes to bad. Okay, but there are other views in the Midrash, and there's also other views in modern readers and in the Rambam. Okay, so before we start reading the Rambam, let's present the question a little bit more systematically. The question of theodicy, of what literally that means, judging God. The problem of evil in the world depends on three assumptions. One is that God is good. Two, that God is omnipotent. And three, that there is evil in the world, that the unjust suffer. Now, in order to solve the problem, we have to reject one of these three items. You can say that God is not good, right? Why is there evil in the world? Because God is bad. Or that there's two gods, a good God and a bad God, right? And there's many old traditions that are dualistic, Zoroastrianism, Manichaeism, people that said things like that. Although, for monotheists, that's a very difficult path to go down, right? There's one God, so therefore, both good and bad, everything that we perceive as good and bad has to come from God. So God must be good. So that's a difficult one to change. The second one, that God is omnipotent, right? So if you say that God cannot do everything, well, there's evil in the world because, well, God does his best, right? But God can't stop every single petty theft and every single insult, and every time someone trips, it's a lot of work to do. God can't be in every place at once. So if you say God is not omnipotent, you say God is good. He tries his best. He can't do it. But that's also a very strange view, a very untraditional view of God. We think God can do everything, and so therefore he should. And the third assumption, that people do suffer evil, meaning there is unjust suffering. Well, this is the easiest one to knock off, because you can always say, if someone is suffering, they deserved it. So in fact, there is no evil in the world. Any suffering is deserved. And that's what the traditional view, the wisdom view, rejects the third one and keeps the other two. But we're going to see through the Rambam and through other readings, perhaps it's possible to keep the third, because that's what a Yov does after all, and then try to re-engage one of the first two.
But inherent in this is the assumption that God has a will and a desire to impose that will. Mm-hmm. And that...
Okay, so that's how we're going to have to, right? That's what we're going to have to try to not completely reject either of the first two, but delve into our understanding of what it means for God to be omnipotent and what is the nature of good and evil. Okay, so now that we have our agenda set, let's delve right in. Rambam talks about Sefer Iyov in two chapters. In part 3, chapters 22 and 23, which we'll get to in a few minutes. But before that, that's really the end of a discussion that starts a few chapters beforehand about his idea of providence in general. And so let's start with part 3, chapter 12, where he defines what is evil, what are the types of evil that exist in the world, the types of suffering that we find. And really, you know, when you turn on the news, the 11 o'clock news, you can get a very depressing picture of society, right? 11 o'clock news, all they show you is this mother murdered her children and all the terrible accidents that happened and the plane, right? It just lists all the horrible things that happened in the city and in the world that day. And if that's your perspective, then you would come out assuming that the city is a horrible place, crime is everywhere. If you walk out of your house, you're going to get run over by a car, right? And it's a very grim picture. Sometimes we see politicians saying the crime rate is terrible, therefore we have to do this or that, right? And so there's an idea, because I guess bad things are more reportable than good things, right? I mean, you don't turn on news and say, everything went as expected today, right? Most people got to work okay. Most people had lunch and didn't choke, right? Most people enjoyed their evening with their families, right? That's not really, no one's going to turn on the news for that. So because bad things raise more interest and gets more readers, that's why the front page of the news is usually bad news. Yeah?
Is there a theory in Judaism, like in other religions, that bad things happen to somebody not because of thinking in this way or thinking in this life?
We'll see. That's one of the opinions, yes. Okay, so Rambam addresses this square on. It seems this is not a new thing because of cable news. This has existed way a long time ago. Men frequently think that evil, he means women too, that evils in the world are more numerous than good things. Many sayings and songs of nations dwell on this, right? If you take all the pop song, hit songs, right, they're all about broken love and missing someone and so on. So it looks like most people are depressed most of the time. They say that a good thing is found only exceptionally, while evil things are numerous and lasting. Not only common people make this mistake, even many who believe that they are wise. And he goes on, I skipped a little, he quotes some wise Arab writers that write about this. The origin of the error is to be found in the circumstance that this ignorant man, and partly among his common people, judged the whole universe by examining one single person. For an ignorant man believes that the whole universe exists only for him, as if nothing else required any consideration. If, therefore, anything happens to him contrary to the exception, he at once concludes that the whole universe is evil. If, however, he would take in consideration the whole universe, form an idea of it, comprehend what a small portion is of the universe, he will find the truth. And he quotes a pasuk from Iyob, Af ki enosh rima uben adam tolea, man is but a worm. And this quote from Iyob is supposed to be uplifting, right? And so he's saying, if you look at the whole picture, it's true, there are cases here and there of terrible tragedies that happen every day, somewhere or other. But you're just focusing on a very small piece of it, especially if something bad happens to you. The world is a terrible place because look what happened to me. But if we realize that we are just a very small part of the entire picture, and 99% of the time things go well, then you will see that there is a lot more good than evil in the world. So we've already solved 99% of the problem, right? Very good. I once had a teacher, it was high school, mathematics regents, and so he gave us a test on the first day of class. And they're like, well, we didn't learn anything yet. So take the test, take a regents test. And so we all got about 50. He says, good, one day and you already got 50, right? Two more, another day, then you'll learn the rest. Okay. All right, well, we solved the easy part, so it doesn't count. Okay, it is of great advantage that man should know the station, not erroneously imagine that the whole universe exists just for him. And the many evils to which individual persons are exposed are due to defects existing in the persons themselves. So he's now going to explain that most of the things that we feel are suffering are really our own fault. Which in a way is saying that, okay, it is because of sin. Well, let's see, what are the three kinds of evil that exist in the world? The first kind is that which is caused to man by the circumstance that he is subject to, Genesis and destruction, because we possess a body. Here he's saying that, listen, if you never want to get feel pain or get a cut or get a paper cut in your life, then you can't be made out of skin, right? Because that's just the nature of a human body. This is what's going to happen. If you want to never feel anything, you could be a rock. And if you're a rock, you'll be fine. You'll never feel any pain, but you won't be a human being. And so just part of the nature, intrinsic, in the way the world is created, is that anything that is material, is made out of matter, is necessarily, just as it's formed, it's going to degenerate, it's going to decompose. Cells will last a certain duplicate a certain number of times, and then they will stop, and the body will get old. That's just the nature of having a body. So if you're wishing for something unrealistic, that you want to have a different kind of body or a different being, then you won't be a human being anymore. And so you're saying, you know, I wish I wasn't a human being. Now the point is, you human beings are created in the best way possible for a human being to be. Right? Within the species, we are perfect. We have amazing abilities to heal ourselves, to be, most people are healthy most of the time. And so if we just recognize the nature of matter, the nature of biology, then we won't be bothered by things that are just due to circumstance. Okay, so this is the first kind of evil. He says, the second paragraph, you would find that evils of the above kind which befall men are very few and rare, for you find countries that have not been flooded or burned for thousands of years. There are thousands of men in perfect health. Deformed individual exceptions, exceptional occurrences. Part of the nature of the world is there are going to be earthquakes, but they're far and few between. Okay, this first kind, it isn't evil, it's not because we did anything wrong, it's just the nature of the world. The second, so we call that natural evil. The second kind, class of evils, is such evils as people cause to each other when someone uses their strength against another. These evils are more numerous than those of the first kind. Their causes are numerous and known. They likewise originate in ourselves, though the sufferer himself cannot avert them. This kind of evil is nevertheless not widespread in any country of the whole world. It's a rare occurrence that someone plans to kill his neighbor or rob him. Many persons are, however, afflicted by this kind of evil in great wars, but these also are not frequent, if the whole inhabited part of the earth is taken into consideration. Okay, second kind is moral evil. And this too, we can't blame God for moral evil, right? If someone trips me or on the street or insults me or does something bad, that's not God's fault. That someone else did it, and the person has free will. So that's just moral evil, right? Do you want to be the only person that exists in the world and not have society? Okay, fine. Then if you have that, no one else will do anything. But we wouldn't want that. And these also are few and far between. Most of the time, the murder rate is pretty low today and back then also. So this is not such a great thing that we have to fret about. All right, that's the second kind. Actually, the truth is that the first kind of natural evil, as technology progresses, this is an insight that Moshe Halbertal has said, as more and more technology we have, the more that natural evil becomes moral evil. How so? If we have technology to build homes that can withstand an earthquake, and we don't, right? Then that's not a natural evil, that's a moral evil. If we have medicines that can cure diseases that millions of people have, and we don't make it available to them, that's not a natural evil of the disease. That's a moral evil that we're not doing what we can to make that medication available, right? So that's these two categories. But Rambam really wants to focus on the third class of evil, which is those which everyone causes to himself by his own action. This is the largest class, far more numerous than the second class, especially of these evils that all men complain. Only few men are found that do not sin against themselves by this kind of evil. And Iyo refers to it. It says suffering doesn't grow out of the ground. It doesn't come from nature, but rather Adam le'amal yulad. This is how he's reading it. That we bring this trouble to bear. Why? Because of our excessive desire for eating, drinking, indulgences, and so on. We bring afflictions upon the body. The soul, when accustomed to superfluous things, acquires a strong habit of desiring things which are neither necessary for the preservation of the individual nor for the species. The point is that for our actual health and life, we need very few things. We need air, and luckily, that's what we need the most. And Rambam goes on and says, luckily, that's the most available. It's free, it's available, it's everywhere. All right, and that's the thing that the body needs most. You can't live for even a few minutes without air. Second most important thing you need is water. You can't last more than a few days, a couple of days without water. But luckily, that's also very plentiful. It used to be free. Now we have to pay for our water. But still pretty cheap, right? And at least you don't have to carry it on your head. Okay, and so water is available. Food, okay, so some basic food, right? A little shelter, that's all you need. Everything else is superfluous. And so what we do is we say we need all kinds of luxuries, indulgences, and then we go around and have to work very hard and fret and worry about, I look at my nice Porsche that I bought, and then someone scratches it, and now I'm all upset because my Porsche is scratched. Who asked you to have a Porsche to begin with? I remember I went to Holland for on a bicycle trip, and the people there, that everybody rides bikes to work and everywhere, and you see they all have broken down bikes, all right, horrible, everybody says, why is everybody riding these old bikes? And I asked one of them, and I said, this is because we don't want it to get stolen or scratched, so we don't care. We just ride it to work, we leave it somewhere, no one's going to steal it. If they do steal it, who cares? If it bumps into it, nobody, right? They also have their good bikes at home when they really want to go on a real ride, right? But it's much easier if you just are happy with the basics. Then you never have to worry about all the things that most people worry about most of the time. Says nobody really needs gold and silver and sapphire or emerald or rubies for anything. They don't do anything, except for medication sometimes. But you can replace these with herbs, other supplements that are much cheaper. Okay, so Rambam, this is a critique on society. And saying we bring all this really upon ourselves, all these things that we complain about, make a list of all the things people complain about. Most of them, right, are just things that they don't actually need, but we become addicted. The same way a real addict is addicted to alcohol or something, we are addicted to our lifestyle, and that causes evil upon ourselves. Okay, so it's interesting. I love this piece because it's as true 800 years ago as it is today, probably more true today than it ever was. And so far, Rambam didn't solve the problem, but he made a lot of headway, right? His what he's saying is that there is a lot more good than evil in the world. Beforehand, he also says that good evil doesn't exist on its own. Evil is actually the lack of good. The same way cold is just the lack of heat. Right, coldness doesn't actually exist. So it's just that whenever we're not taking care of ourselves, we're naturally going to decay. So the truth is that evil is much less than you think. Most of the world is good. Most people are born healthy. Most people live nice and healthy lives. Most places don't have terrible earthquakes. Most of the time, people that meet on the street don't stab you. Right? And it's true. There are things that happen once in a while, but you can't really blame God. God made the world and human beings as perfect as possible, and everything else is due to other human beings or things that we cause ourselves. And if we would get used to the minimum, this kind of, minimalistic way of life, and we create societies that are moral, then actually there would be very, very little evil in the world. So don't think the problem is so big. Okay. All right, so that's the first, minimizing the problem. But still, we didn't solve it altogether, because there is still some evil in the world.
Yeah, and it's not a comfort for those who are suffering.
And for that person who has gone through something terrible, or is going through something terrible.
No.
But Rambam here created theism, basically. I'm glad I came to audience and saying. Everything we read here has nothing to do with God's will, other than initial creation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no...
It's not deism as a bad God. There's no evil God.
No, but there's no Mishkahan.
Wait, he's going to get to that now. Okay, so that's this chapter. Okay, all right, good. So now we're ready to delve a little deeper. And so on page 3, we're going to jump to chapter 17. And here is where Rambam, he likes to do this on every subject that he covers, and Arab philosophers did this, Aristotle liked to do this, is present all the different theories that are out there, and then in the end he will tell you his own. Why don't he just tell you the right one at the end, to begin with? Well, I think he has to acknowledge that there are these other theories that people think and show why they're wrong, right? Also, sometimes he's not always clear about which one he actually holds true, so he likes to present them all to kind of confuse you. Okay, so here he presents 4 theories and then his own. So 5 theories. So let's go through them and see what they are. So these are four theories, then 5th, concerning divine providence, right? What is the role of God? How does God interact with the world? And through that, why is there evil in the world, even if it's not a lot? Okay, the first theory says that there is no providence at all for anything in the universe. God has nothing to do with the world at all. Now, you'll say, the heavens and what they contain, how are they, if they weren't created, how did they come to be? They owe their origin to accident and chance. There exists no being that rules and governs them or provides for them. This is the theory of Epicurus. That's the same word as Hebrew, apikoros, comes from the Greek philosopher Epicurus, who assumes that also that the universe consists of atoms. Epicurus was kind of advanced in science. He knew about atoms. He even predicted a little bit of quantum theory, the way atoms kind of have a mind of their own and are unpredictable. So Epicurus was a brilliant mind. Actually, not everything that is ascribed to him in the negative sense of a pikoros, are what he actually said, because his detractors would like make up propaganda, like bad things that he actually didn't say. But in any case, everything is mere accident, and Rambam rejects this outright. Even Aristotle has proved the absurdity of the theory that the whole universe could have originated by chance. He has shown, on the contrary, there is a being that rules and governs the universe. Right? If everything is by chance, why? How did the world come to exist? How does it continue to exist? Why should there be any order or rules or laws of physics or existence at all if everything is just chance? So this doesn't make sense at all. Okay, good. The first theory would say, would reject both the first two of the, right, that God is good and God is omnipotent, would say there is no providence at all. So the first theory has no problem of evil, but it has a problem of everything else. Okay. Second theory, while one part of the universe owes its existence to providence and is under the control of a ruler and governor, another part is abandoned and left to chance. This is the view of Aristotle about providence. And what he says is that God controls the cosmos, everything from the moon and above. He thought of the world as a kind of onion with the earth at the center, and then layers and layers where all the planets and stars are. And you look up at the stars and you see how the planets move. Everything moves with a constant motion, and so there must be order in the world. But when it comes down to the sphere of Earth, here we have free will and we can do things, and God is not directing every little thing to move or not move or decide. On Earth, we have our own independent existence. Although Aristotle would agree that providence does come down to Earth in a general sense and will ensure that species, humans, animals, fish, birds, will continue to exist as a species. Okay? But not to an individual cat or dog or fish. So what is this about? I'm not going to try to translate Aristotle into modern terms because most of his science has been rejected.
This is basically deism, like the 18th century deism.
It's not quite deism. Deism is the idea that God created the world and then left it. Right? Aristotle is different. Aristotle says that God continues all the time to have force that continues in the world. How so? I think we kind of take for granted that there are laws of physics in the universe, right? There is gravity and nuclear force, strong and weak nuclear force, electromagnetic force. Aristotle didn't know about all these, but I'm trying to translate it into nowadays, and we can ask ourselves, why should there be laws of physics? Why should there be rules that the universe follows, right? Why don't they change from day to day or minute to minute? Right. This implies that there's something in the world. There's some providence, you might call it, right? Or governorship of the world that has to continue, right? And if God would abandon it, then those rules themselves would be gone. And those rules are not arbitrary, but think of those four rules. Three and a half of them are rules that bring things together, right? Gravity, the nuclear forces, electromagnetic force between positive and negative. Because if you had four forces that push everything away, then all the atoms in the universe would just scatter and nothing could exist, certainly not life, or not even rocks, right? So it's kind of amazing that, scientists don't have a way to explain why this should be so. They're only describing what they see. So I think if Aristotle was around today, or Rambam was around today, I think they would marvel at the idea that there exists these rules of the universe. And that is the sense of providence. So that you could call providence in the cosmos. It's not that, as Aristotle thought, that God is constantly pushing the spheres, the planets, to move. Aristotle wouldn't even say it that way. The spheres are kind of just following God, like the way a person creates a shadow. It happens automatically. I can't stop my shadow, right? But still I'm causing the shadow, even without purposefully doing it. So in that sense, right? But I think you could say, so God in that sense creates those rules, continuously upholds them, and in the sphere below, well, here we have free will. Even animals, they decide things. But, according to the laws of biology, in a way ensure that life continues and different species continue, and even if there's an earthquake here and someone gets a terrible disease and so on, that happens at an individual level, and God doesn't get involved on that micromanagement level. But on the macro level, we know that somehow we will adapt to any changes that will happen, and we as a whole will continue to exist. Life will go on. Right? And that itself is a manifestation of God's providence. All right. Now, according to Aristotle's view, why is there evil? How do we explain the problem of theodicy, that innocent people suffer? He says, in fact, yes, innocent people suffer. So he's affirming the third. God is good? Yes, God is good, right? God is a positive force in the world. How about God being omnipotent? When we say God is omnipotent, we can't think of God being a micromanager, but rather omnipotent in the sense of controlling everything. But the small things that happen in the world are God left to chance. So there is some chance built into the world, and that's why there's evil. So God is still omnipotent, but you have to just change the definition of omnipotent. Got that? This is the view of Aristotle.
He left to chance or he left to man?
So both, half and half, right? Very good. So the first, going back to the previous chapter, the first natural evil is left to chance. The second and third kind of evil is left to man. Right, so even in this third one, see how this fits together with the previous chapter, it's very, very few things will end up with actual evil.
What about if it's left to nature? In other words, this is just the laws of nature that work out. Mm-hmm. So the ship sinks or what have you. So it's not chance, really,
right,
per se.
Right.
But just the laws doing their thing.
Right, the laws are doing their thing. The laws overall are good. It's good that there should be climate and that there should be terrible storms sometimes because it kind of renews forests and things. And if you happen to be living there at that time, you know, it's terrible for that person. But overall, the laws of nature are good. And so individual suffering is diluted among that good, overall good. Okay, to the question before, what if you're the person suffering? I think there's something, you know, even if you are suffering something terrible, knowing that the world in general is a good place, I think still is comforting, right? This goes back to Rambam saying, don't think you're the center of the universe, right?
Yeah, but knowing that somebody is suffering nearby is not good when you're not suffering either. It makes you suffer.
Right, knowing that there is someone. I'll say, you know, like an example, you know, let's say, you know, someone who lost a child as a soldier in the war. But you won the war, right? So knowing that most people survived and that we won, then makes that suffering a little easier to bear. That had meaning, had purpose. Josh.
Sometimes suffering, unfortunately, is not just on an individual basis where you see what's happening, for example, in Syria. So when it's happening on such a large basis,
It's happening on a large basis, true, it's a lot, but still, Rambam would still say it's only a small portion of the overall population. What percent of people, how long is it going on for? Okay. I mean, you don't want to minimize, but you still want to have the right proper proportion. Okay, Rafe, last.
I was going to ask you how you're defining evil.
I'm defining evil as unjust suffering. Right? If it's justice, right, person, then that's not evil.
So when a cat eats a mouse,
he says that example. Yeah.
That.
Okay.
So when a cat eats a mouse. Or not. It's good for the cat, but bad for the
mouse. It's good. That's right. And Rambam would say it is bad for the mouse. Too bad mouse. And that's why God does not have providence over every individual animal.
So, in your definition of unjust suffering, it's a very relative definition because it depends on what perspective you're looking at it from.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, if the
You know this well, right?
If the bond market goes down, then you...
Yeah, it's good for somebody who's short.
It's good for someone who's shorted. If the stocks go up, it's good for someone. Okay, let's go on. So that's the second theory of Aristotle. Third theory is is the reverse of the second. According to this, there is nothing in the whole universe, neither a class nor individual, that is due to chance. Everything is the result of will, and this is held by the Islamic school of the Ash'ariyah. So they say that God is the ultimate micromanager. Every single thing, every atom, electron that moves in the universe, God is directing it. Now, it might look to you like there's a pattern, and usually if I let this go, things, it will fall. But in fact, there is no law of gravity. God is causing it to go down. And the best example I could think is if anybody's a computer programmer, you'll know that if you're programming a game or anything, right, you have to program in every little thing, every dot on the screen, what it's going to look like in a way that the user will think that it's all seamless and that things fall down when you're playing a game and things calculate up and when you press W in Word, W comes up, right? And so it looks like to the user like, yeah, the computer knows what it's doing. And that's why you get angry at the computer when it doesn't listen to you, right? But a programmer knows that computer has no mind, computer is not following any human known rules. Rather, you have to tell the computer every little thing, and going down to the hardware level, the programmer, in a way, is pushing every little tiny magnet and every dot on the screen. Right. So, in that sense, that's how God actually deals with the universe. Everything is controlled by God, which means that humans don't have free will. If someone murders someone else, that's not evil. God directed it to be so. Now, if you ask, well, why did God do that? The answer, only answer you can give is God willed it. Right? Because God said so. So in this reading, right, they would, in order to give all control to God, actually has to do away with justice. In this reading, God is omnipotent in the fullest sense. But God is not good. Right? God doesn't follow reason or morality. God just does whatever he wants. Right? Why to do this? This is like a bewildered parent who just like, you know, or boss. It's a crazy boss that tells people to do all kind of things and change his mind and do that. You know, why is it? Because he said so. That's all. Yeah.
So in the
there's no moral evil, that's right. There's no moral evil because what I do is not actually a result of my will. What?
And no good.
There's no good, there's no evil, right. There's no problem of evil because, you did it right. I mean, according to this theory, here's the top of page 4, first paragraph, it has to be assumed that all actions of God have no cause, no final cause, no reason. These absurdities are admitted by the Ash'ariyya for the purpose of saving this theory. I mean, you know, they want to say that God micromanages, and as a result, they have to come up with all kinds of strange ideas. There's no injustice can be asserted to him for that. According to their view, it's proper that God should afflict the innocent and do good to the sinner because God felt like it. Yeah. No, according to this, no. Right? So there's some things that we experience as good or evil, but actually God couldn't care less.
And another, that this probably is the closest thing to the non-pagan view where the universe has divine power, which is not exactly...
Maybe, right, maybe something
like
that.
The nature is mm-hmm. divine, which is exactly opposite.
Okay, maybe a kind of pantheism might be something like this. I mean, you can find statements kind of like this in the Talmud, like no grass grows without an angel commanding it, you should grow, right? That there's no, things don't happen just on their own. Jeffrey.
In theory number 3, if in fact Islam believes that this is the case, how then do you align...
Not all of Islam, there's just one school.
How then do you align that with the reward that they get in heaven?
No, that's the fourth theory. Okay, good. So let's go to the fourth theory. One second. So the fourth theory is that of a different school of Islamic thought, the Mu'tazaliyah. And they said that people do have free will. It is therefore intelligible that the law contains commandments and prohibitions and reward and punishment. According to the first view, there's no point in saying, thou shalt not steal, because I have no free will anyway. The second view says, yes, all acts of God are due to wisdom. No injustice is found in him. Now, why do bad things happen to good people? Well, that's because God is doing bad for them to give them greater reward in the future world, right? And if someone evil is getting good, God is giving them good in order to make them suffer more in the world to come. So this is the view of the Mu'tazaliyah. You can find this in Zoroastrian thought. You can find this in some statements in the Talmud also. We saw it regarding Iyov, right? One statement says, God gave him reward in the end in order to remove him from the next world. Moshe, you want to say something?
Hey, the question, could it be the Asharia that we don't understand, or we don't, what is the will of God?
We don't understand what is the will of God, because the will of God has no follows no reasonable.
No, because we cannot understand the reasoning.
No, this is saying we do understand. We understand that there is no rhyme or reason for it. Third view.
So there is.
Right. There's no morality. The third view rejects morality altogether.
Reason is a human concept.
It's a human concept. Right. Okay, so that's the fourth view. The fourth view you can find here and there in Judaism as well. Okay, the fifth view.
How about that fourth view? This is where they're coming with the 72 version waiting for them?
Yes. Exactly. Okay. Now, Rambam says they go further in their absurdities, because we ask them, why is God only just to man and not to other beings? How is it that irrational animals sin? What about the mouse? About the Mu'tazaliyah, the cat ate the mouse. What did the mouse do? So the mouse can get Olam Haba? They say, yeah, the mouse is going to get great Olam Haba because it got eaten by the cat.
Isn't another view to say the poor cat, how hungry it is?
Right, let's pick on something else. Okay, fifth view. This is our theory, or that of the Torah. I will show you first that the view expressed on the subject is in the prophetic books and generally accepted by sages. I will then give you some opinion of later authors. I'll explain my own beliefs. So the fifth view says that if someone suffers evil, then they must have sinned. The old traditional wisdom view, right? It's they did something wrong in this world. Okay. I'm not going to dwell on that because that's the standard view. Let's turn the page to number 5. And let's look at the bold part. The different theories are now fully explained to you, everything in varying human affairs due to chance, according to Aristotle, the divine will, according to Asharia, divine wisdom, according to the Mu'tazilites, the merits of man, according to our opinion. It is therefore possible, according to Asharia, that God inflicts pain on a good and pious person in the world and keeps him forever in the fire, which is assumed. Okay, so he just summarizes what we just said. But then Rambam says, a fifth view, my own opinion on this principle of divine providence, I will now explain to you. And this is a surprising paragraph, because the fourth view, he says, was the view of the Torah. So wouldn't you expect that the Rambam's view would be that of the Torah? But no, Rambam says, no, I have another view. Okay, so this is, right. So in the principle which I now proceed to expound, I do not rely on demonstrative proof, but on my own conception of the spirit of divine law and the writings of the prophets. So, see, Rambam is saying, I am relying on the Nevi'im. This is something that you will find in Tanakh, even though, so when he said the fourth view is the view of the Torah, it means he is the view that's generally believed by people, by tradition, by rabbis, by people who follow Judaism. But Rambam says, I find a different view within the Judaic tradition itself. It is this. In the lower or sublunary portion of the universe, divine providence does not extend to individual members of the species, except for the case of mankind. I agree with Aristotle regarding all other animals. So this is a variation on Aristotle. When it comes to things above heaven, God makes the rules and makes everything right follow them. And on this earth, animals have only general providence, so God is not micromanaging anything. When it comes to human beings, there God does make sure. For I do not believe that it is through the interference of divine providence that a certain leaf drops from a tree, or that a certain spider catches a certain fly. That is a direct result of a special decree and will of God at that moment. I don't think so. In all these cases, it is entirely due to chance. But divine providence is connected with divine intellectual influence. So why are human beings different from all other species? Because we have a mind, and we can... Well, so how does it work, right? We have a mind, we can make good decisions, right? And the better we think about it, the better decisions we'll make. And to comprehend things comprehensible to rational being are also under the control of divine providence, which examines all their deeds in order to reward or punish them. And maybe by mere chance that a ship goes down with all of her contents, as in the above-mentioned instances, the roof falls down upon him and those within, that in one instance the men went into the ship or remained in the house, in the other instance, it is due to the will of God and is in accordance with the justice of his judgment, the method of which our mind is incapable of understanding. So he says, this is due to chance that the ship, a big wave will come and sink it. So God is not going to stop a ship from being saved, but he might prevent a person from entering the ship in the first place. Now, how does this work? There's two ways of understanding this. One is the supernatural way, right? God will control the person's mind and make sure, right? This is the famous when you miss the plane and then the plane crashes. So yes, no, right? Okay, but that's a supernatural way of thinking it. The other way of thinking about it is that an intelligent person will look at the ship and say, this is not seaworthy, or I know this captain, he looks drunk, and decide, makes good decisions, and doesn't do things that are reckless or dangerous. Yeah?
But on the other end of that, when we get sort of part of the problem, right? Because there are freak accidents that you just, right? Like, we're not calculating every decision, oh, there's a 0.2% chance that this ship is going to sink, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are instances which I think any reasonable person would say,
yeah.
I
suppose, but there might be less than you think. So how would Rambam think about the bicycle accident that happened in the Olympics? Okay, this is going to sound a little cold, but I think Rambam would say, putting yourself on two thin wheels going downhill at 60 miles an hour is...
On a wet road.
Is not an intelligent thing to do. An intelligent human being wouldn't do that. And the cyclist would say, yes, but I have a helmet. I'm okay, right? But Rambam would say, no, that's not good enough. And so we've created a culture where this is common, and the truth is, Rambam would agree, most people don't fall, or if they do fall, they don't break their spine, and so on, right? But the whole idea that we've created, is this a freak accident, or have we created a weird system that we allow this thing to happen? What about the next rider that just whizzed by and like, you know, oh, too bad for her, but now I got the gold, right?
It's interesting because that would require, like, it seems like the perception of us is like hyper-rational. Right, like every decision we make is calculated, but to a certain extent that's impossible, right? I walk into a room, I'm not calculating the millions of
probabilities. Look, in 30 years from now, they're going to look back and say, do you remember when we let people drive? What were we thinking, right? We're putting people behind the wheel, they're tired, they're drunk, they're listening to the radio, they're talking on the phone, and my life is in all these people's hands if I'm crossing the street. Any one of them who doesn't press on the brake in time, and then I'm pancake. Right? So, this is an insane system. I think we do think about it when in health. Many people are thinking about exactly what, you know, not to have any hydrage and thing and what, right? So we are hyper-calculating, right, some of the time, and sometimes it helps. okay, so I think that's what, you know, you have to look at the big picture here. Okay, we got to move on because we don't have too much time. Okay, so chapter 22. Now we get to Sefer Iyov itself. Bottom of page 5, the strange and wonderful book of Iyov treats of the same subject as we are discussing. Its basis is a fiction conceived for the purpose of explaining the different opinions which people hold on divine providence. You know that some of the sages clearly said that Iyov never existed and has never been created, and is a poetic fiction. Those who assume that he has existed, page 6, and that the book is historical, will determine when and where Iyov lived. Some of our sages say he lived in the patriarchs, this time, that time. The difference of opinion supports the assumption that he has never existed in reality. So Rambam supports the reading that we did before, last week, that says if there's so many different opinions, then that means nobody really knows. Okay, and so therefore Rambam is saying that this entire book of Sefer Iyov is a parable to discuss this very question that we've been discussing until now of providence and therefore what is evil. Whether he existed or not, that which is related of him is an experience of frequent occurrence, is a source of perplexity to all thinkers, and has suggested the above-mentioned opinions of God's omniscience and providence. Right? The point is saying, it doesn't matter if this story never happened, because this is a story that happens every day to everybody. The perplexity is caused on account of that a simple and perfect person who is upright, very anxious to abstain from sin, is afflicted by misfortune, and so on. Now, so now that we know that's a mashal, Rambam's going to explain the details. He says there was a man in the land of Utz. Utz has different meanings, and it's related to Utzu Etza, take counsel. So there's a man who lived in the Eretz Utz. He's saying there's a man who's living in. Being encouraged to hear advice, right? He has to go through a learning process. So Utz is not a real place. It just means that this is a book of wisdom that will teach you something. Okay, this is fascinating because last week we saw how the rabbis say Utz means, is also an allegory, means etz, tree, because Iyov protected his generation like a tree. And in fact, as someone was said did mention last week, Utz is the name of a place, which I forgot where it was last week. But in Echa, does mention Sisi v'Simchi Bat Edom Yoshevet Be'eretz Utz. So Utz is a name of a land mentioned in Echa and Yirmiyah. There seems to be somewhere in Edom. Utz, the person, is also one of the descendants of Esav. So we have three options. If we think it's a real story, or at least it could be a fake story, but still in a setting of a real place. So it is a real place, but that place might be chosen because of the resonance of the name with teaching, taking counsel. Okay, and he goes on in the rest of this chapter. He wants to say, listen, even if you think it happened, the first chapter didn't happen. First two chapters, because it's talking about angels and Satan, and Rambam doesn't think angels actually exist in the literal sense, and certainly not Satan. And so therefore he says this is an allegory. What is Satan an allegory of? Well, he already is bracing out in the Midrash. The Midrash said Satan is the same as the angel of death, is the same as Yetzer Hara. Satan from the language of meaning to cause someone to veer, means the evil inclination, the inclination in each of us for material things and all those earthly affairs and things that we don't really need. And so the way he's reading it is that this story that looks like it's happening in heaven with the angels and Satan going up and conversing with God are actually an internal conversation in Iyov's own mind, and Iyov, who never actually existed, it's really in all human beings' minds, right? And it's each of our voice in our head saying, you know, are you a really righteous person, or are you just faking it? Do you really fear God and serve God, or do you just have ulterior motives? Right, and even the most righteous person has to wonder to himself and herself, and what is my real motivation? Am I going out and doing this act of chesed so that everybody will say what a great person this is, and so I'll get praise from other people? Am I studying so people will say, look how smart this person is, or do I really care about the thing in itself? And so this is the test, right? This is the test that we're all constantly thinking about ourselves. And so we can read the entire first two chapters as an allegory to our own motivations. And so as we see, Iyov in the beginning is described as Sadmerah, right? But it doesn't say he's Sadiq. It doesn't say he's Chacham either. right? And so Yov has to, because he's wondering, what is my true motivation? So therefore, this kind of test, the scenario occurs in order to think through this question of what if we are tried, will we pass the test or not? Because it's only through trial that we'd be able to. I mean, you might have, I mentioned the rich husband last week. I mean, you know, it's easy to love your spouse when your spouse is, takes you out every night and makes you laugh and is good looking and has a good job and all that. But the second they lose all that, do you still love your spouse? Or like, okay, time to move on, right? John Edwards style. But, okay. So that's the question that we all ask ourselves. And Rambam is saying, don't read this as an actual story. Read this as a psychological, religious psychological allegory. All right, that's what he says in chapter 22. Okay, and so we can move on. One thing that I won't have time to get to is he notices that certain words regarding Satan, and he says, I got something that is kind of like prophecy, a prophetic insight into this. And then he doesn't really explain what his prophetic insight was. Okay, but we have a question. Did Rambam think he did have prophecy? Here's one place where he says,
yes.
Where he seems to say, yes, he did. Okay, so now chapter 23. So he says, Iyov and his friends agreed that the misfortune of Iyov was known to God, and it was God that caused the suffering. They further agree that God does no wrong, and no injustice can be ascribed to him. Rambam here is saying, you know, those three assumptions that we had in the beginning. And when you consider the words of the five who take part in the discussion, there's five. There's Iyov, three friends, and then a fourth person, Elihu, comes at the end. You will easily notice that the things said by one of them are also uttered by the rest. The arguments are repeated, mixed up, and interrupted by Iyov's description of his acute pain and troubles and so on. There's a problem. Whenever someone reads Sefer Iyov, it's a long book, 42 chapters, and the dialogue goes through round and round, and the three friends, they all look like they're saying the same thing. They're just saying, Iyov, you must have sinned, you did something wrong, stop complaining, and Iyov coming back and saying, no, I didn't, right? And who could be my judge, and God won't give me a fair trial, and so on. And so it looks like there being three friends is just a literary device, because it has to be three in every story, but they're not actually saying anything different. And so therefore, you have to really love poetry to read through the whole thing. I did give a class once going through the whole chapter, but by the end, they wanted to kill me. I asked Professor Kugel one time, I said, why does it keep repeating? And he says, the author must have been a great poet who just loved writing poetry. Okay, so that's what it seems to any reader, and even, you know, the best scholars nowadays cannot find a unique voice in each of the three friends. But Rambam did. So let's turn the page over. The way the Rambam says it is, well, we have the three friends are Eliphaz, Bildad, and Sofar. And he says on top of page 8, the first view of Iyov is one of the different views that are held by some of the thinkers on providence, which is our sages. So Iyov, who says that there is suffering in the world that's unjust, that's actually the opinion of Aristotle, right? Iyov was following the opinion of Aristotle in the beginning. And then the second opinion set forth by Eliphaz is the bottom of page 8, in reference to Yov's suffering, is likewise one of the current views of providence. He held that the fate of Yov was in accordance with strict justice. Yov was guilty of sins for which he deserves fate, so Eliphaz represents the traditional view, what we call the view of the Torah, or wisdom, right? That all sin causes punishment, and all suffering comes from sin. Turn over to page 9, Bildad defends in this inquiry the theory of reward and punishment. He therefore tells Iyov that if he is innocent and without sin, his Talmud Sforch will have the source of great reward, will be followed by the best compensation, and will prove a boon to him as a cause of great bliss in the future. And we've seen those words. If you be pure and upright, right? He tells Iyov, if when in fact you're saying it's true that you never sinned, surely now he will awake for thee and make the habitation of the righteousness prosperous. Though thy beginning was small, yet thy latter end will increase. So what opinion is this like? The Mu'tazilites, right? That you get greater in the end than you did before. And Sofad says that divine will is the source of anything. This is the opinion of the Asherites. And he quotes a pasuk, right? But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against thee, and would show thee the secrets of wisdom, for wisdom is two portions, I know. Therefore God exacts of thee less than thine iniquity deserve. Can you, by searching, find out? Can you find out the Almighty unto perfection? You can't understand God, but actually you're getting less than you deserve, and God just has his will. He decides what to do. And so what Rambam does is he says, well, look, I had four theories of providence, and there are four different opinions, Iyov and his three friends, and so he matches them up. And he finds a pasuk or two for each one. Okay, now is this a convincing reading of Sefer Iyov? Well, each of the friends said lots of things. So, right, you can find one pasuk. It looks like Rambam has a kind of preconceived a structure, and now he's trying to fit it in. Rambam knows better than that, don't worry. And he says on the bottom of page 9, the purpose of this repetition is to conceal the opinion peculiarly to each speaker and to make all appear in the eyes of the ordinary reader to utter one and the same view, although in reality this is not the case. He's saying the Sefer Iyov is purposefully mixed up, right? And so that a simple reader will read through all of them and just say, okay, there's two views going back and forth, they'll kind of get bored of it, and now, you know, he won't think about the problem again. But if you look carefully, there is a unique voice in each of the voices, and that is these prototypical models that he is talking about. Okay, so he figured out the whole thing here. Okay, the view ascribed to Iyov is that of Aristotle. Eliphaz holds the opinion of the scripture. Bildad is identical with that of the Mutazilites. Sofar defends that of the Ash'ariyah. Very good, let's go to the last page. Now, what is the conclusion, right? What is the conclusion of the book? And he says, Elihu, who's described as being a young person, because this is a theory that was thought of later in time, and this is the correct view, and the view that Iyov eventually adopts. So, according to Rambam, Iyov actually learns along the way. And Iyov was wrong in the beginning, because in the beginning he held Aristotle's view. And then he hears the other three views, that of the traditional scripture, that of the Asherites, Mutazilites, rejects them all, and God says they are rejected. That's also true. And in the end, he comes to Elihu, and Elihu's view is the same as Rambam's own view. Or the other way, Rambam adopts the final view of Elihu. And where does he find this in the words of Elihu? Elihu says, even if a person is terribly ill, there is an angel with him. If he has an angel with him, one among a thousand, he can show him his uprightness and he can get better. In other words, it's not that providence happens all the time to everyone, but individuals who have achieved perfection in a moral and intellectual perfection, they can in fact be saved and will have that providence upon them. And so, in fact, evil does not happen to a truly righteous person. Now, is that true, what I just said? Evil doesn't happen to a truly righteous person? If you look back on page 8, we'll wrap up with this point. On page 8, I have a footnote. The footnote is to one of the last chapters in the Moreh, where he says, divine providence is kindly watching over those who have obtained that blessing prepared for those who endeavor to obtain it. If man frees his thoughts from worldly matters, obtains the knowledge of God in the right way, rejoices in the knowledge that it is impossible that any kind of evil should befall him while he is with God and God with him. So he's saying here that a truly spiritual person connects with that, right, the divine being, what he calls active intellect, that is in the universe all the time. You tune in, right, you plug in, and therefore you get the shield around you, and no evil can happen to such a person. And so this solves the problem of theodicy, because God is good, God can do everything, and not everybody, evil can happen to some people, but the truly righteous person, no bad will come to him. That's what he says there. But in the middle of this chapter, he says something different. If you look where the footnote is, right in the middle of page 8. As soon as he acquired a true knowledge of God, Yoav confessed that there is undoubtedly true felicity in God's knowledge, is attained by all who acquire knowledge, and no earthly trouble can disturb him. He's saying, the truly righteous person, something bad might happen to him, but he won't be bothered by it. Right? And you have here a contradiction. And we're not the first to notice this contradiction. Already in Rambam's own lifetime, his translator, Ibn Tibbon, noticed these contradictions, and he was in contact with HaRambam, and he wrote Rambam a letter and says, what do you mean? Sometimes you write that no trouble will happen to him. Other times you say, it will happen to him. Rambam, can you explain this to me? Because I need to translate it. And Rambam never responded. Right? Maybe he just didn't have a chance, so more likely, he didn't want to respond. Because Rambam wants to keep these different readings open. I think Rambam himself recognized that sometimes bad things happen, even to very righteous people. But it's very, very rare. And his real point is that the truly righteous person, as we said in the beginning, is focused on the big picture. The big picture of all humanity, of all time, the big picture of God's purpose in the world. I don't know if you could think of some example of someone who's like deeply involved in solving some mathematical puzzle, right? Proving some theorem, and his whole life is devoted to that. The way these Olympians, their whole life is devoted to this, you know, 5, 10 seconds of something. And if this person should happen to fall and hit his head, but at that moment he solved the problem, he wouldn't care about his physical pain, right? Because what's more important, he got to solve this problem. And so too, the righteous person who is thinking about God's moral perfection of the universe and bringing society to peace and people understanding truth and respect and so on. So if some small thing happens to him, or even if a big thing happens to him, in relation to his entire worldview, it will seem like a very small thing, and he won't be bothered by it. And so, to conclude, Rambam takes the whole book of Iyov as a deep reflection on providence and the problem of evil. And he sees within it, within this conversation, well, in the beginning is their own psychological doubts about this, and within the conversation with the friend, sees all these classical different views that people have taken and why each one is wrong. And in the end, Iyov learns, and we learn as readers, to think of ourselves with humility. Rabbi Sacks once said, what is humility? It's not to think less of yourself, but to think of yourself less. and thereby to really gain a divine perspective on the world. And when we have that, then, well, there is a little, it's an itty-bitty problem of evil in the world, but it's very rare in quality, in quantity, and in quality. So I'm not sure if this solves the problem altogether, but I think Rambam's perspective is still very relevant and very important, and makes us think about our own priorities and our own goals in our own lives. And I think the more we think about this view, in fact, the better we will be able to understand and persevere through challenges that we confront. Good night. Have a wonderful week.
I think there are two problems that are not solved, no matter what. One is the person who is born with deformities.
Yep.
So, you know, there's impairment. Thank you.